Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm here to just ask you to silence your phones, and then we'll get going on the panel. Thanks.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is George Krupp, and I have the pleasure of introducing Annette Gordon-Reed. Before I do that, I just want to tell you, give you a perspective as to why my family has supported the Civil War piece of the book fair. As you all know, this is the beginning of the almost five-year celebration of the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. And from my perspective, the Civil War changed dramatically the way we looked at the United States. We determined what type of a country we were going to be, centralized versus states' rights. We certainly determined how we were going to deal with slavery. The result of the Civil War not only created an industrial power in the United States, but also destroyed the culture of the Old South as it was known pre-war. So very interesting 150th anniversary. I'm only going to say two things about Annette. First, I'm not sure which, first and foremost, but you pick it. Two things. She was the winner of the 2009 Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award for her book on the Hemings of Monticello, An American Family, and she is a professor of Harvard Law and History. So, Annette, it's your show.
Thank you. Thank you very much, George, and thank you for the brief introduction. And thank you for the sponsorship, Liz and George Krupp, sponsorship of this event. I'm not going to take as much time as necessary to introduce our illustrious panel, because it would go on and on. I'm going to try to do the best I can, reading very quickly and with as much articulation as I can. Adam Goodhart is a historian, essayist, and journalist. He's the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening, which was published in April 2011 by Alfred A. Knopf. The book became a national bestseller, a front page review in the New York Times. The book review called it exhilarating, inspiring, and irresistible, adding 1861 creates the uncanny illusion that the reader has stepped inside a time machine. Mr. Goodhart's articles and essays have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Smithsonian, National Geographic, The Atlantic, and The American Scholar, among other venues. He's a regular columnist for the New York Times online Civil War series, Disunion. Mr. Goodhart teaches American Studies and History at Washington College, where he's director of the C.B. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience, an institute that fosters innovative approaches in studying, teaching, and writing about American history and culture. I've been down there myself. It is a wonderful institution, and it's a great place that supports his work and the work of history, and it's a fabulous institution. I'm going to introduce them in seriatim, in order of their speaking. Tony Horwitz is a native of Washington, D.C. He's a graduate of Brown University and Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. He worked for many years as a reporter, first in Indiana and then during a decade overseas in Australia, which I will have to talk to him about, Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, mostly covering wars and conflicts as a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. After returning to the United States, he won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting and worked as a staff writer for The New Yorker before becoming a full-time author. Four of his books have been national and New York Times bestsellers: A Voyage Long and Strange, Blue Latitudes, Confederates in the Attic, and Baghdad Without a Map. Tony has been a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University and a visiting scholar at the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University. Charles Brayson Flood is the author of 12 books, including Grant and Sherman, The Friendship That Won the Civil War, and the best-selling Lee, The Last Years, which garnered great critical acclaim. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution pronounced Lee, The Last Years, an American classic, and the noted journalist Theodore H. White hailed it as the story for which we have been waiting over a century. Flood graduated from Harvard, where he was a member of Archibald MacLeish's noted creative writing seminar, English S, and was on the literary board of the Harvard Lampoon. He also told me that he spent a brief time at Harvard Law School. We have to talk more about that afterwards, how he decided to leave that experience behind. Before tackling the Civil War, Flood was a best-selling novelist and journalist. His work has appeared in, among other magazines, The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, and Esquire. Flood is a past president of Pan American Center and has served on the governing bodies of the Authors League and the Authors Guild. He was a senior Fulbright scholar in Taiwan and taught at Sophia University in Tokyo. His most recent book, Grant's Final Victory, Ulysses S. Grant's Heroic Last Year. Drew Gilpin Faust is the 28th president of Harvard University and the Lincoln Professor of History at Harvard's Faculty of Arts and Sciences. They had a great celebration last night of 375 years of Harvard's history. Historian of the Civil War in the American South, President Faust was the founding dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. Previously, she served as the Annenberg Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania, where she was a member of the faculty for 25 years. President Faust received her bachelor's degree from Bryn Mawr College in 1968, her master's degree in 1971, and her doctoral degree in 1975 in American Civilization from the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of 6 books, including the award-winning Mothers of Invention, Women of the Slaveholding South in the American Civil War, published in 1996. Her most recent book, The Republic of Suffering, Death in the American Civil War, published by Alfred A. Knopf in 2008, looked at the impact of the Civil War's enormous death toll on the lives of 19th century Americans. It won the Bancroft Prize in 2009 and was a finalist for the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize and was named the New York Times one of the best 10 books of 2008 by the New York Times. President Faust has served the historical profession in too many ways to list in its entirety, including being the president of the Southern Historical Association. She's a member of the Society of American Historians, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society. This is, I can't think of a better group of people to assemble to talk about this subject, this enormous subject, as George mentioned. All of these people approach the topic from different directions, and we hope to have a lively discussion after they do their presentations and to take questions as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Annette, and thanks to all of you for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. Although, you know, it's tricky talking about the Civil War because you want to tell the story, but you don't want to give away the ending. So I'll try not to give you guys any spoilers, but if you want to ask me afterwards, I'll tell you who won. It's also, you know, it's challenging to talk about the Civil War because people feel so strongly about it today. If you talk about, for instance, the War of 1812, you don't really have to worry about somebody leaping out of the audience wearing a British redcoat uniform and charging the stage. But I sometimes do feel like that might happen with the Civil War. I spoke last week at Clemson University, and before I went on, I had the daunting experience of having the host tell me, you know, I got a funny phone call this morning from a gentleman who asked me, is that event on the wall of Northern aggression open to the general public? And that was somewhat daunting, too. And I have a feeling that's not as likely to happen in Boston, though, for which I'm grateful. But in fact, it's also daunting just to write about the Civil War, because amazingly enough, well, perhaps not amazing given the number of Civil War books that one sees in the bookstores, but still, the statistic always astonishes me that there's been more than one book published about the Civil War for every day since the surrender at Appomattox in 1865, which is a whole lot of books. And you might wonder, what is there really new to say? Hasn't every story indeed been told? In fact, back in the 1920s, James Thurber, one of my favorite humor writers, said that at this point, and this of course was almost a century ago, he said, at this point there's been a Civil War biography of absolutely everyone except for one obscure Union Army sergeant named John Schwartz from Ohio. But that's actually not true. There were 30 million Americans, North and South, at the time of the Civil War, and each one of those Americans had his or her own story. And the thing that fascinates me, indeed, about the war is the way that something so great, so epical in American history, in any history, indeed, can be experienced both as a collective experience and as a very individual, personal experience. I had an interesting experience myself, actually, traveling up here to Boston a couple of days ago. I was waiting for my flight at National Airport in Washington, which we're now officially supposed to call Reagan National Airport, but I insist on continuing to call National. Thanks. So I was, wow, I didn't expect to get applause for that, but I am in Boston. So I was waiting for my flight when an announcer came over the PA system and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a few moments before your flight, we invite you to come over to Gate 38, where we have a very special group of travelers arriving. We have 150 members of the Greatest Generation, 150 veterans of World War II, who are on their way from Nashville, Tennessee, down here to Washington to visit the World War II Memorial, and we invite you to come and pay them your respects." So I looked at my watch. I had about 15 minutes before my flight, and I went over, and there were a few dozen people who had gathered, and somebody in the crowd had distributed little American flags to us, and we were all waiting. And, you know, like all of us, I've seen a lot of World War II veterans before. I've known a lot of World War II veterans. And yet, there was something about that moment as these men, one by one, began filing up the ramp into the airport, and we all stood there waving flags, and they had a little choir that started singing the Marine hymn. And I was reaching out and shaking these men's hands one by one, and I got all choked up. And I couldn't help but think in that moment, this must be what it was like in the 1830s, 1840s, to see the last surviving veterans of the American Revolution parading. In fact, my book begins with the story of one of these last revolutionary veterans coming here to Boston in 1860. Or it must be what it was like in the 1920s and 1930s to see the last veterans of the Civil War. And in fact, that history is still so close to us. Last night I spoke out in Lexington, and a very old woman came up to me afterwards at the signing table and started telling me stories of family members she had personally known as a girl who had fought in the Civil War. The history is very close. But as I saw these men filing out, you know, each one of them, they're dressed in these sort of identical baseball caps, these red baseball caps with the name of their veterans group in gold letters on the crown. And yet, each of them was a very different man. Some were striding along very strong and very straight. A few were riding in wheelchairs. And as I looked at them, I wondered what each of their individual stories was, how each of them came into that moment of American history, that moment that began on December 7th, 1941, with the attack on Pearl Harbor, and how it had changed their lives, and how they thought that it had changed their country. I really wanted to stay there and interview each of these 150 men in turn, and then write a book that would be called 1941 instead of 1861, but I had only about 5 minutes until my flight, so I went running off to catch my plane, waving my boarding pass. But in fact, that is what fascinates me about the Civil War. It's the sense that there was this generation, I don't know if we can call it a greatest generation, but a pretty extraordinary generation in many respects, that lived collectively a great and tragic moment. In fact, that moment, the moment when the guns of the Confederate troops in Charleston Harbor opened fire on Fort Sumter, and when thousands of people gathered on the rooftops, watching as across the rooftops of their familiar city a great column of roiling smoke rose into the blue sky, a moment that actually has resonances not just with Pearl Harbor, but with things that most of us remember in more recent history. And they looked at that tableau, not knowing yet what it meant, not knowing yet what it might bring, or even knowing what was at stake, what might be won, what might be lost in this unfolding conflict. It's remarkable to me that so many people in that generation, so many of these 30 million Americans, were able to, one might say, rise to the occasion of history. And not just, as we know, sacrifice, many of them sacrificed their lives. And again, this was something last night. This woman who came up to me after the talk told me, she said, my grandfather came back from prison camp in Louisiana with TB and infected his children. He died after 8 years after the war, and so did my mother's four sisters. And I thought, wow, here's a family loss that continued afterwards. So there was that sacrifice, but there were also great things to be won. And that's something that, as I wrote my book and as I studied the very first weeks and months of the war, it was remarkable to me how many Americans, not only the ones who went off to the battlefields, rose to the occasion of turning this into a new birth of freedom. That was not simply something that was accomplished by Abraham Lincoln, who coined the phrase. It was also something that involved, and I'll just give you, before I close, one very short story. One of the most surprising stories that I uncovered in my book, I'm not the first to uncover it, but narrated in my book, was the story of a community of Virginia slaves at the very beginning of the Civil War. And in particular, three young men, three African Americans, who escaped from slavery in the very first weeks as the war began, and made their way to a place called Fort Monroe, a Union Army bastion near the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, sort of a lone Union Army bastion in the midst of Confederate territory. And these three men presented themselves asking for asylum from the Union troops. Now, the commander of the Union troops was a Massachusetts man. In fact, he was the governor of Massachusetts after the war, General Benjamin Butler, a very proficient and successful lawyer before the war began. And Butler, seeing these three slaves arrive, had to decide what to do. On the one hand, Abraham Lincoln and his administration had made it very clear that this was not a war to end slavery. He had stood on the steps of the Capitol and proclaimed in his inaugural address that he had no intention of interfering with slavery anywhere it presently existed. And yet, on the other hand, here were these three men. Every soldier in Butler's garrison knew that they had come into the fort. They were largely New England troops, many of them college-educated, an entire company from Cambridge, Massachusetts, in fact. Many of them abolitionists. How could he send them back? How could he send them back, moreover, to work on the Confederate fortifications, which is what they had been conscripted to do? And so when the Confederate Army officer came riding up to the fort the next day under flag of truce, asking for the return of these three fugitives, the canny Benjamin Butler looked at him with his one good eye. He was not an attractive man, General Butler. Looked at him with his one good eye, and he said, "You know, if you insist on treating human beings as property, I will treat them as property as well. And just as I might confiscate a shipment of swords or muskets being used for the Confederate service, I will confiscate these slaves." And the Virginian looked at him and said, "But you insist that Virginia is part of the United States, and as such, that the fugitive slave law is still in effect." And Butler looked back at him and said, "But you insist that Virginia is not part of the Confederate States, and I propose to take you at your word." And a revolution began in that moment. The following day, seven African-American slaves appeared at Fortress Monroe seeking asylum. The day after that, 45, and this time not just young men who are working on the fortifications, but men and women and children, including, I was very moved to read, an 85-year-old slave who, as I thought about it and did the math, this enslaved person was born in 1775 or 1776, if they were 85, in 1861. And so from that year of freedom had waited almost a century for freedom in truth as well as in theory. And before long, hundreds and then thousands of African Americans were fleeing slavery into Fort Monroe and indeed to Union forts and Union lines, wherever there were Union forts and Union lines throughout the South. They became known as the contrabands. And I believe had as much to do with the end of slavery in America, with turning the Civil War into a new birth of freedom, as did Abraham Lincoln or indeed anyone else. And I'll close with just one final vignette as testimony to that. And that's a story that happened more than a year and a half later, in the fall of 1862, on the very day that Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was announced. A Union Army colonel was walking across Lafayette Square in Washington opposite the White House when he happened to run into Secretary of State William H. Seward. And he said to Seward, Mr. Secretary, I congratulate you on the historic deed that the administration has done today. And Seward looked at him quizzically. And if you've seen photos of Seward, you know that he did quizzical looks very well. Looked quizzically and said, sir, what historic act do you mean? The colonel, shocked, said, the emancipation of the Negro. And Seward said, we have merely let a puff of wind over an established fact. The emancipation of the Negro was decreed in the first gun fired at Fort Sumter, and we have been the last to hear it. And I think there were a lot of things that were decreed in that first gun fired at Fort Sumter, and so I think there are endless stories to be told about the Civil War and about the many things that were decreed, both deliberately and even more so, those many twists and turns that history takes that cannot be expected, that could not be predicted in that moment. So thank you.
That was great. So we should keep writing a Civil War book for every day into eternity. It's endless. Thanks to all of you for coming out. This is actually my first time talking about my new book, Midnight Rising, to anyone other than my family dinner table. So unlike Adam, I'm going to glance at some notes so I don't lose the thread, if there is one. My book is about John Brown and his raid on Harper's Ferry, which occurs in October 1859, 18 months before the Civil War. So we're a little out of chronological order here. But I'd like to suggest that what happens at Harper's Ferry in 1859 and with John Brown before that sheds tremendous light on the national conflict to come. And in some ways, the Civil War is already underway long before that first shot at Fort Sumter. I'd also like to use the short time I have today to share a few things that I came away with from my research that perhaps run counter to enduring stereotypes about John Brown, his mission, and his times. And the first concerns Brown himself. This is an easy man to caricature. In art and lore, he's generally depicted as this sort of wild-eyed, wild-haired fanatic, probably insane, certainly on the far fringe of his society. But as I discovered, that's not really true to the man. For most of his life, he was actually a well-groomed businessman, an American on the make, who favored starched shirts and dark suits. He was a wool trader, a land speculator, a tannery owner who took business trips to Europe. He didn't grow that famous scary beard of his until the last 18 months of his life when he went underground and needed to disguise his identity. Brown was certainly extreme in his views on race and slavery, at least extreme for his day, but he wasn't a wild and absurd freak, as the New York Times called him. He was homegrown, an American striver and family man radicalized by his times. And that raises another misconception, which I think many of us have, about America before the Civil War. And by us, I mean the general public, not the scholarly community. I think, thanks largely to Gone with the Wind, many Americans still cling to this image of a romantically doomed South, a feudal and agrarian world that was destined to be swept away in this modernizing and industrializing time. And looking back through the prism of its defeat in the Civil War, the South has this aura of underdog and lost cause. But things appeared very differently to Americans at the time, in the 1850s, who obviously couldn't see the future. The South didn't seem the underdog. Politically, it had been top dog for all but a few years between the nation's founding in the 1780s until the eve of the Civil War. It held sway over the White House, the Supreme Court, and Congress. The slave-grown cotton economy wasn't wilting, it was booming and expanding into states like Texas, and Southern leaders were lobbying to extend the institution not only to Western states in the U.S., but to Cuba and Central America. And even though the North had a much larger share of the nation's population and industry and railroads, the South often seemed the brasher region, boasting that cotton was king and no one dared defy it. And anyone who did was mocked, intimidated, and beaten. This was illustrated most graphically in 1856 when a senator from this great state, Charles Sumner, delivered a stinging speech about slavery and those who sought to extend it to Kansas. In reply, a South Carolina congressman, Preston Brooks, walked onto the floor of the Senate and almost caned Sumner to death in plain sight. And this led to Brooks being lionized in the South for, quote, lashing into submission the Senate's most vocal abolitionist. This and many other episodes made any slavery Northerners feel the nation was being bullied by barbarous Southern-led extremists, perhaps a little the way many liberal Democrats feel today. Why is no one standing up to these thugs? And that's a big reason John Brown makes such a mark. He's the rare Northerner in this period who punches back hard. Most abolitionists in this era are staunch pacifists who put their faith in education and moral suasion and believe that blacks are too docile and inferior to fight for their own freedom. Brown derides this as what he calls milk and water abolitionism. Slavery, in his view, is a state of war and must be met in kind, with both blacks and whites fighting to destroy the institution. And he first does so in Kansas, which in the mid-1850s is the front line in the brewing conflict over slavery and whether it will extend to new territories. And at first, Southerners seem to be having their way in Kansas, intimidating and killing free state settlers and burning the free state capital of Lawrence. But just days after Lawrence's burning, which occurs the very same week as Sumner's caning in the Senate, Brown leads a night attack on a pro-slavery settlement in Kansas, slaughtering five men with broadswords. As one of his sons wrote of the massacre, the enemy needed shock treatment. Death for death. Brown then takes to the field and engages pro-slavery forces in open battle. In the summer of 1856, 5 years before the First Battle of Manassas, you have organized units of Northerners and Southerners fighting open field combat with musket and cannon. These are skirmishes, really, but they're a miniature of what's to come. Brown's exploits also have a very bracing effect on anti-slavery Northerners. As one admirer writes after Brown makes a brave stand at a place called Osawatomie, this has proven most unmistakably that Yankees will fight. As that quote suggests, this was a matter of some doubt at the time and would remain so right up to the start of the Civil War. Now, Brown uses his Kansas fame to collect money and guns for a much more ambitious campaign. He wants to take the war into Africa, as he calls the slaveholding South. His plan is to lead a guerrilla force into Virginia, seize the huge federal armory at Harper's Ferry, free and arm slaves, and spark an insurrection that will roll across the South. Now, this sounds wild, a wild scheme, and it was. In military terms, it ultimately failed miserably. And it came to be known as John Brown's Raid, which sounds like one man's act of banditry and makes Brown seem a lone gunman or bomber of the sort we've seen at other times in our history. But this is, again, a misconception. Brown wasn't alone at all in his violent crusade. While seeking funds for his campaign, he was feted at parlors and lecture halls across New England, dined with Thoreau and Emerson, and drew support from Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, and other leading activists. His core financial backers, known as the Secret Six, were some of the most prominent intellectuals and magnates of their day, most of them from this area. Four were Harvard men, two were ministers. One was a Medford industrialist who made his fortune from manufacturing lead pipe and linseed oil. Brown was an extremist. He didn't want reform. He wanted revolution. But so did many others who cheered him on or gave money and guns to his cause. Many others were eager to fight alongside him. And one of the things I most wanted to do in writing this book was to bring these extraordinary and little-known accomplices to light. The men who fought with Brown in Kansas and later in Virginia weren't cult followers or suicidal zealots. They were farmers and factory workers, immigrant Jewish shopkeepers, lawyers and poets and blacksmiths who were prepared to leave their farms and jobs and families and risk their lives for a cause they passionately believed in. In many respects, not unlike hundreds of thousands of young men who would later serve in the Civil War. There were women, too. In the summer of 1859, Brown, posing as a farmer named Isaac Smith, rents a secluded log house in the Maryland Hills, 5 miles from Harper's Ferry, where he gathers his soldiers and weapons. And he's joined by his teenage daughter, Annie, and his daughter-in-law, Martha Brown, who act as lookouts and camouflage for this guerrilla band. Whenever a neighbor or passerby approaches, Martha and Annie greet them on the porch or in the yard and play the part of ordinary farm women while the men huddle out of sight in the farmhouse attic. Annie Brown writes wonderful letters about this tense, sweaty summer hiding these romantic young idealists that she refers to as my invisibles. Fortunately, they're not invisible to us, because while cooped up in this farmhouse all summer, the men received and wrote dozens of letters to friends, families, and lovers. And I think, as Adam said, this is a crucial part of the Civil War story. It's easy to be numbed by the statistics and the scale and death and suffering. But as he said, and I'm going to steal this line, it's an individual as well as a collective story. And one of the things I love about Harper's Ferry is that it offers an unusually vivid and intimate look at the people engaged in what's about to become a national bloodbath. And I'll give you just one example. This remarkable band that Brown assembles includes 5 black men, one of whom is Dangerfield Newby. He's a Virginia-born slave who is freed when his owner moves to Ohio, but his wife and children are still in bondage in Virginia, and he's desperate to free them. He works hard and saves a considerable sum of money for a former slave and tries to buy their freedom, but their owner raises the price and chooses not to sell. And this leads to a desperate series of letters from Newby's wife, who fears she's about to be sold to a gang labor plantation in the Deep South, a common fate for Virginia slaves at the time. "Oh, dear Dangerfield, come this fall without fail, money or no money," she writes in the summer of 1859. "If you do not get me, somebody else will, and then all my bright hopes for the future are blasted. If I thought I should never see you again, this earth would have no charms for me. Do all you can for me, which I have no doubt you will. Your affectionate wife, Harriet." Dangerfield Newby heeds this plea and joins Brown's band at its Maryland hideout, carrying Harriet's letters with him. Then in October, Brown leads his men into Harper's Ferry, sparking a bloody street battle. And the first of the raiders killed is Dangerfield Newby, shot dead in the street, where his body is dismembered by white Virginians. And a few months later, Harriet is sold to a slave master in Louisiana. This brutality is another way in which Harper's Ferry foreshadows the Civil War. Brown misjudged the willingness of white Southerners to fight in defense of slavery. He even thought some of them would join him. After all, few whites in Harper's Ferry owned slaves, and their economic and social status was very different from the plantation masters that Brown targeted. Yet white Virginians instinctively grabbed their guns and rushed to oppose the northern invaders, just as rebel soldiers would do in the years that followed. The fight at Harper's Ferry also embroils a number of figures who will become very prominent in the Confederacy. The soldiers who quell the uprising are led by Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart. Later, Stonewall Jackson and John Wilkes Booth appear on the scene. And Jefferson Davis leads the Southern charge in condemning the raid, declaring it grounds for secession, quote, even if it rushes us into a sea of blood. In this, as in many other respects, the Harper's Ferry drama is almost a dress rehearsal for the carnage to come, which I think the other speakers will now tell us about. So thank you for listening. Are you next? Yeah.
Well, I very much appreciate the chance to be here. I want to thank the Boston Book Festival for creating this opportunity for all of us, and Deborah in particular for the advance information and the hospitality we've received since we've been in this area. My book begins in May of 1884, 29 years after Appomattox. Grant is 62 years old, and the most famous man in America. He's also on his way to being the most photographed man of the 19th century. In addition to his enormous contribution to winning the Civil War, he has served two terms as President of the United States. Grant was not in good health. Among other things, this man of slender build had gained 40 pounds since his wartime weight of 146. He used crutches as a result of falling on an icy New York City sidewalk. However, no one, including Grant, had any idea that he had only 14 months left to live. As we open on Grant, he and his wife are living very comfortably in Manhattan. They're able to afford this lifestyle because of the generosity of rich New Yorkers, including J.P. Morgan, who chipped in quite a lot of money because they saw in Grant the same kind of determination, the same kind of vision, and the same general view of life that they had themselves found took them to success in entirely different fields. My plan now is to take you back to the beginning of Grant's life and give you some of the highlights on his way through to 1884. I want to give you the man as he really was, rather than as he has so often been portrayed. Grant has been described as humorless, a man who would never laugh at himself. He was tone deaf and said, "I know two tunes. One is Yankee Doodle and the other isn't." Grant was the son of the operator of a small tannery in Ohio and graduated from West Point. After serving with distinction in the Mexican War, he married Julia Dent, the highly intelligent, vivacious, cross-eyed daughter of a pre-war slaveholding family in Missouri. The Civil War historian Bruce Catton called their marriage one of the great romantic American love stories. Separated from Julia while serving in a remote army post on the Pacific coast, he became desperately lonely and was drunk on duty during a payday. His colonel gave him the option of facing a court-martial or of resigning from the army. Grant resigned. 7 years later, when the Civil War began in 1861, he returned to the Army. Starting as commander of a regiment with less than 1,000 men, he rose to become General-in-Chief of the United States Army, then the Union Army for the time being, a force of more than a million. In the process, and here is a point that so many have missed, he became a transitional figure in the history of warfare. At Shiloh in 1862, he was riding back and forth behind the lines of his infantrymen who were firing at lines of Confederate infantrymen some 40, 60, 80 yards away. By the time that Abraham Lincoln brought him east in 1864 to command the entire Union Army and to oppose Robert E. Lee in Northern Virginia, he was communicating with his corps commanders by telegraph from his headquarters miles behind the front. Contrary to the myth that he was often drunk, at no time during the war was he incapable of effective action because of consuming alcohol. During his meteoric rise among Union generals, Grant not only developed enormous administrative skills, but became a great strategist. More than any other general on either side, he understood that the rivers of the South were an integral part of a vast battlefield area and could be used as avenues for penetrating and cutting up the Confederacy. Lincoln described it in this way: once Grant gets hold of a place, he acts as if he had inherited it. While it's true that Grant spilled a lot of blood in his frontal attacks on Robert E. Lee's stalwart forces, it's also worth remembering what Lee thought about that. When Lee's subordinates were telling him about the way that Grant was recklessly piling up casualties, Lee replied, "I think General Grant is managing things very well." Virtually every American knows the story of the way in which Ulysses S. Grant set new standards of military honor by his gracious and kind way in which he accepted Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse. But many are unaware of what came next. Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, intended to have Lee tried for treason, a crime that was punishable by death. Grant walked into the White House and told Johnson that Lee was protected by the parole that he, Grant, had given Lee and all his men at Appomattox. Grant added that if Lee were arrested, he would immediately resign from the Army in protest. Johnson and his federal prosecutors had no intention of arguing with the immensely popular, victorious commanding general of the United States Army. They quietly halted the treason proceedings. Lee was never arrested. For the remaining years of Lee's life, he never allowed a word against Grant to be spoken in his presence. I'm going to leave aside for the moment, if anybody wants to get into the questions, the 8 years of his presidency, but I do think this is a very important thing. A few weeks after he was inaugurated, Grant, on the subject of civil rights, paid this tribute to the ratification of the 15th Amendment designed to protect the rights of blacks to vote. And he said, "A measure which makes at once 4 million voters who were heretofore declared by the highest tribunal in the land to be not citizens of the United States, nor eligible to become so, is indeed a measure of grander importance than any other act of the kind from the foundation of our free government to the present day." It's worth noting that in the recent and long overdue movement among biographers and historians to restore Grant to his rightful place in American history, Professor Sean Willance of Princeton takes the position that Grant did more for civil rights than any other president between Lincoln and Lyndon B. Johnson. Once more, I want to bring the less known side of Grant to your attention. After his White House days, in 1879, Ulysses and his wife Julia embarked on a 2-year trip around the world. Planned as a private sightseeing journey, it turned into an immense international tribute to Grant. He symbolized the burgeoning post-Civil War America, an industrial and military power to be reckoned with. All this brought Grant and Julia to what neither one of them thought would be the last chapter of his life. The year of 1884 found them living in Manhattan in a handsome townhouse just east of the fabulous Millionaire's Mansions on Fifth Avenue. This was the era in our history known as the Gilded Age. And here I see in my notes the words, "Take a sip of water whether you think you want it or not." Okay. Grant and his son, Ulysses S. Grant, Jr., had become partners in a Wall Street investment firm known as Grant & Ward. The moving spirit of this enterprise was Ferdinand Ward, known as, quote, the young Napoleon of Wall Street. Trustingly, Grant had put all his money under Ward's management and had encouraged all of his immediate family to do the same. At that moment, Ward was showing prospective investors papers indicating that the firm had a capitalization of $16 million. On that basis, Grant had reason to think that he was personally worth, as he put it, quote, nigh onto a million. This at a time when household servants were paid $5 a week. The financial catastrophe struck swiftly. Overnight, in May of 1884, Ward's fraudulent financial house of cards collapsed. He had been running what a later generation would call a Ponzi scheme. Grant and his family lost all their money. A description of Grant as he was at this juncture was left by Robert Underwood Johnson, a brilliant young editor on the staff of the Century magazine. Johnson met with Grant at his and Julia's summer cottage in Long Branch, New Jersey, to discuss the possibility of his writing articles about his famous battles and campaigns. Johnson found a man far different from the gruff warrior he expected to encounter. He wrote, "The man who, we had been told, was stolid and reserved, showed himself to me as a person of the most sensitive nature and the most human expression of feeling. Grant, quote, gave me the impression of a wounded lion. He had been hurt to the quick in his proud name and his honor. He told me, frankly and simply, that he had arrived at Long Branch almost penniless." At Long Branch, to give you an idea, Julia, who for 8 years had had the White House staff at her disposal, did all the cooking for her Ulysses, as she called him, and their family and guests. With Johnson guiding him, Grant began to write about Shiloh, the first of four articles describing his victorious battles. He found that he enjoyed it, and Johnson was the first to discover that the same man who could write the clearest, most direct orders and after-action battle reports was capable of descriptive writing that transported a reader into the middle of gunfire and the neighing of cavalry horses. As Grant focused his prodigious powers of concentration on his four articles for the Century, he began to think of expanding this initial effort into what became his massive and powerful personal memoirs. It was now that Grant's friend Mark Twain entered the picture. Twain, already greatly famous for his Adventures of Tom Sawyer and other works, was about to publish Huckleberry Finn. He made Grant an offer that was both generous to Grant and, although speculative, potentially very lucrative for himself. He would publish Grant's memoirs through a small publishing firm run by his nephew, Charles Webster, and would give Grant $200,000 as an advance against the venture. Twain, always a man for images, described the arrangement this way. "If these chickens should ever hatch, General Grant's royalties will amount to $420,000 and will make the largest single check ever paid to an author in the world's history. If I pay the general in silver coin at $12 per English pound, it will weigh 17 tons. As Grant continued writing in the summer of 1884, he suffered increasing pain and discomfort in his mouth. By late October, this had been diagnosed as cancer, primarily of the tongue, the result of smoking literally thousands of cigars. This was, in fact, a death sentence. The dramatic question now facing Grant and the American public when they later learned of it was this: could he complete his memoirs before he died? During the spring of 1885, as Grant pushed himself ever harder as he wrote in his house in Manhattan, the people of both the North and the South, while still divided concerning post-war political issues, began to come together in an example of the American respect for courage and the native instinct to pull for the underdog. Mark Twain had been right in thinking that Grant could recount his Civil War experiences effectively, but he was bowled over by what he now saw and read. Averaging a production of 750 words a day, while in a condition in which he likened a drink of water to, quote, molten lead, Grant was putting on paper a work of remarkable literary quality. Twain compared these memoirs with Julius Caesar's commentaries, saying, the same high merits distinguish both books: clarity of statement, directness, simplicity, manifest truthfulness, fairness and justice to foe and friend alike, and avoidance of flowery speech. General Grant's book is a great, unique, and unapproachable literary masterpiece. There is no higher literature than these modern, simple memoirs. Their style is flawless. No man can improve upon it. During these months, it became evident that Americans, not only in the North but the South, had come to have a special feeling for Grant. He had always had his critics, but other than during his White House years, he was referred to and thought of as General Grant. Learning of his grave illness, crowds often gathered outside his house on East 66th Street. When he sometimes appeared to go for a carriage ride in Central Park, the reactions would range from applause to solemn silence, with men in the crowds taking off their hats. At the time of Grant's 63rd birthday, on April 27, 1885, 20 years after the nation's great redemptive moment at Appomattox Courthouse, it was clear that a new generation, not born at the time of the surrender, was growing up with an inbuilt feeling toward a man who, like Lincoln, had preserved the Union. Typical of the letters he received from young people was this one from Maggie Irving of Louisville, Kentucky, a border state during the war. She said in part, "I am a little Louisville girl who likes you so much. Old General Grant, please, please get well. I don't write you to get your autograph or anything of the sort. I only write to let you know how we all love you. I hope you won't suffer a bit. General Grant, please accept the best wishes and love of this little Louisville girl." He also received this birthday greeting from the Confederate Survivors Association, meeting in Augusta, Georgia. Remembering him now as the generous victor who, at the ever memorable meeting at Appomattox, conceded liberal and magnanimous terms of surrender, do we, standing by the graves of our Confederate dead, respectfully tender to General Grant assurances of our sincere and profound sympathy in this, the season of his direful extremity. Because of the coming summer heat in Manhattan, arrangements were made to take Grant to a cottage high in the hills above Saratoga Springs in upstate New York. At what was known as Mount McGregor, a big new resort hotel named the Balmoral had been built, and this cottage was down a slope some 200 yards from it. Here, Grant dug in for what was literally a do-or-die effort. Finding that writing with a pen and ink exhausted him in his weakened condition, he resorted to dictating as he neared the end of his massive two-volume work. At one point, he had a brief discussion with his oldest son, Frederick, concerning the dedication. Grant had it as, "These volumes are dedicated to the American soldier and sailor." Frederick suggested that this should be changed to specify that he meant the soldiers and sailors who had fought for the North. Grant replied, "It is a great deal better that it should be dedicated as it is. As it is, the dedication is to those we fought against as well as those we fought with. It may serve a purpose in restoring harmony." Grant felt a quiet passion for the nation he had fought to preserve. In what proved to be the last weeks of his life, his mouth and throat choked with mucus and bleeding from cancer, he sometimes dictated in a barely audible hoarse whisper, revised his manuscript with a pencil, and finally resorted to writing his thoughts on pieces of paper. On one of these, he wrote a summation of his feelings to former Confederate General Simon Bolivar Buckner, who came to see him at Mount McGregor. Excuse me. What he said was this: "I have witnessed since my sickness just what I wish to see since the war, harmony and good feeling between the sections. I believe myself that the war was worth all that it cost us, fearful as it was. Since it was over, I have visited every state in Europe and a number in the Far East. I know, as I did not before, the value of our inheritance. On July 20th, 1885, Ulysses S. Grant finished the last changes he wished to make in his manuscript. 3 mornings later, with his family surrounding his bed, his last moments began. He died with Julia holding his hand. A temporary resting place for Grant had been selected in Riverside Park on Manhattan's cliffs high above the Hudson River, and a circular brick mausoleum had been built there. On the day that Grant's coffin, now closed, was brought up there from where he had lain in state downtown in Manhattan's City Hall, the largest crowd ever to assemble on the North American continent. Estimates ranged from 500,000 to 1.5 million people lined the 5-mile route of the funeral procession. What they witnessed was the United States showing the world how to honor a national hero. Thousands of carriages followed the massive catafalque on which Grant's coffin rested. The crowd saw President Grover Cleveland, past Presidents Rutherford B. Hayes and Chester Arthur, and the justices of the Supreme Court. The governors of every state went by in the order in which their states had come into the Union. On the military side, there was a galaxy of generals. 40,000 troops passed, including the West Point Corps of Cadets, wearing black armbands. Music was provided by 250 bands and drum corps. Proof of how Grant had brought the nation together was the fact that Confederate generals Joseph E. Johnston and Simon Bolivar Buckner were among the honored participants. The last large segment of the enormous parade, a democracy's tribute to the Tanner's son from Ohio, was a column of 8,000 elected and appointed officials from all over the United States. The parade's combination of military strength and the representatives of constitutional law would have pleased Grant, who believed so firmly in the prosperous future he foresaw for the country he had served. In addition to the public outpouring of respect and affection, those who knew Grant well had their more private reactions. On the day Grant died, Mark Twain wrote in his notebook, "He was a very great man and superlatively good." On their own, many citizens, North and South, realized that they already knew that it was possible to be a sometimes ineffective president, but a great man nonetheless. So what has Grant's legacy been? Despite the rise and fall of historical schools of thought that obscured and diminished his role in our history, he and Lincoln remain the two men who did the most to ensure that our country would remain one nation rather than to become two nations, one of which was committed to maintaining slavery as a legal institution. His memoirs were published to great acclaim, and the sales that Mark Twain had hoped for guaranteed that Julia would live very comfortably for the rest of her life. 126 years after Grant finished it, just thus far in 2011, and I particularly throw this in for a book-oriented audience, just thus far in 2011, the personal memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant has sold close to 50,000 copies in 3 hardback and 2 paperback editions. That figure is even more impressive when one considers that the copyright has long expired and unknown numbers of copies are downloaded free from the internet. How do we sum up this unique life? In a speech given 15 years after Grant's death, Theodore Roosevelt placed him in the very first rank of Americans, agreeing that men like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson deserve to be regarded as enormously valuable citizens. He saw Grant as something more than that and spoke of him this way: "As we look with keener wisdom into the nation's past, mightiest among the mighty dead loom the figures of Washington, Lincoln, and Grant. These 3 greatest men have taken their place among the great men of all nations, the great men of all time. They stood supreme in the 2 greatest crises of our history, on the 2 great occasions when we stood in the van of humanity and struck the 2 most effective blows that have ever been struck for human freedom under the law. Of all that was ever written about Grant, nothing would have pleased him more than Julia's heartfelt and lyric memory of the man she called Ulysses. Julia said, 'I, his wife, rested in and was warmed in the sunlight of his loyal love and great fame. And now, even though his beautiful life has gone out, It is as if when some far-off planet disappears from the heavens, the light of his glorious fame still reaches out to me, falls upon me, and warms me. Thank you very much.
My Harvard class tie, which says H51. Does she miss anything? No.
Proud to claim you. I thought I would say a little bit today about how I came to write a book about death and the Civil War, which in some ways seems the most obvious possible topic to write about the Civil War, and yet wasn't a topic that anyone chose to write about until I did. So I guess in retrospect, it seems obvious, but what made me think about it in that way, and what were the questions that led me to frame this Republic of Suffering as I did? My idea for writing this book really came from earlier work I did on women in the Confederacy, on the slaveholding women of the Civil War South. Because as I read their diaries and their letters, I began to realize that the subject that concerned them most, the subject that they came back to and focused on, was death. They hoped for victory, these slaveholding women, in the early years of war. They feared defeat in the later years of war. But most of all, they worried about their loved ones. They worried about losing their loved ones. They worried about the impact of those deaths on their families and their society. For them, war and death were inseparable. And so as I listened to these voices and found this recurrent theme in the hundreds and hundreds of letters that I was reading, I began to listen to them and think about what they were telling me as a historian and what that should mean for the kind of subject that I ought to take up as I did my own historical writing. And as I listened to them, I thought, well, they're telling me something I already know. I know that approximately 620,000 soldiers died north and south in the war. And I know that was a very high death rate, about six times the rate of death for Americans in World War II. And yet I realized I'd never really asked myself what that meant, in terms of the experience of individuals in the war, about how they calibrated their lives, and also what it might mean for America after the war as a society that had experienced that kind of loss. And then I thought about a number that translated the rate of death of the Civil War into our society. If we experienced that level of loss, what would it mean? 2% of the population. That would mean about 6 million dead today. And so that was really a stunning kind of aha moment for me, because I thought if we lost 6 million Americans in a war, that would be what we were thinking and talking about as a nation. That would consume all of us, and it would shape deeply all our values and all our approaches to life. And that number, in fact, of 620,000 is only military deaths. It didn't include civilians who died from epidemic disease or guerrilla conflict or food shortages or what we might call collateral damage to civilians near battle sites. So I wanted to ask myself, how did the nation cope with this level of loss? And what did this mean on every level of experience? I thought of the logistical challenges. What do you do with all those bodies? How do you bury them? What were the basic kind of instrumental demands of such a level of carnage? And then I wanted to ask about the psychological dimensions of such loss. How do humans adapt to it? And how do they come to understand their own humanity in face of such devastation. And I wanted to ask the spiritual implications of this kind of loss in a nation that was deeply religious. To take the words of a Confederate poet, Sidney Lanier, how does God have the heart to allow it? How must you think about God once you see this kind of loss and suffering is possible? And I wanted to ask, too, about the political implications of this loss. How is a nation reshaped once it has experienced such suffering in its own behalf? And how does that have a lasting impact on how a nation defines itself and its purposes? Now, historians are interested in change. That's what historians look for. But often change happens almost imperceptibly over extended periods of time, over decades or even centuries. But I've always found that the real appeal of the Civil War as a historical subject is that it accelerated and concentrated the process of change, and that for a historian, it's a remarkable laboratory to watch a culture under pressure and see what happens, what people hold on to, what they transform. Certainly, the acceleration of change was very evident during the Civil War years in relationship to this subject of death. At the outset of the war, there were no specialized burial details in military units. There were no graves registration units. There were no official dog tags or even official next of kin notification. When I began to realize this, it just seemed unimaginable to me. The Civil War is not that long ago, and yet things we take for granted as the fundamental order of things simply were not in place 150 years ago. A child went off to battle, and you did not even expect you had the right to be officially notified by the government for which that child was going to fight. So here we have a time that seems very close and very far all at once, and also a process of change that was one I thought intriguing to study and possible to study in this very intensive period. So my book is about a revolution in thinking about the dead and about the rights of the dead, about what a nation is and what its obligations are. In a war that ended up being about freedom and rights of citizenship, the rights of the dead became an essential part of defining the state's obligations to those who make up its body politic. It was also, it seemed to me, to talk about death, to think about death in the Civil War, was an opportunity to think about how we define what is human in face of the most profoundly inhuman and inhumane kinds of circumstances. By the end of the war, altered policies were in place, and the United States government that had at the outset of the war articulated essentially no responsibility for the treatment of the dead, undertook a massive reburial program, one that indicated in, I think, very dramatic form the transformation in attitudes that had occurred during those 4 years. Between 1865 and 1871, Union soldiers scoured the southern countryside trying to systematically look not just at battlefields and their surroundings, which were scrutinized very closely, but also every highway and byway, railroad station, or village where a Union soldier might have been laid to rest. And these Union units in the post-war era located over 300,000 Union soldiers buried in the South and reburied them, disinterred them, and reburied them into 74 new national cemeteries. Now, that's a pretty astounding logistical challenge in itself. And it was also a very political act because it was only for the Union dead. This program did not include the Confederate dead. And in that decision sparked a movement among Southern women, in particular white Southern women, to, on a voluntary basis, provide the same sort of care for the white Southern dead of the Confederacy as was being offered through the auspices of the federal government to the Union soldiers who had fought for the North. Even with this careful attention to the dead after the war, more than half of those slain during the Civil War were never identified. They were never clearly identified as people whose fate could be reported to their loved ones. And so think what that meant for the United States as a nation. It meant that a substantial portion of the citizens of the United States after the war were left uncertain about the fate of their loved ones. I began, after learning that, to think of the late 19th century United States as a nation profoundly in mourning unresolved because of the lack of knowledge of what that person actually did, where that person died, whether that person died in pain, in agony, with consolation. And in the minds of many Americans of the late 19th century, there was a kind of denial, a hope that maybe they were just deranged and might return home at some moment. If any of you have read A Long Engagement, which is both a film and a book about World War I, that theme gets taken up very explicitly, the notion that someone is not actually dead, but simply deranged or has amnesia and ultimately returns home. That kind of hoping against reality was something I found very widespread in the letters and diaries of those whose loved ones had not been identified and returned. So how did survivors come to understand their world in the aftermath of this kind of loss? William Dean Howells, a great writer, once commented about James Garfield. James Garfield, who later became president, but during the Civil War was a Union general. And Howells wrote of him and his war experience in the following way. He said, "At the sight of these dead men whom other men had killed, something went out of him. The habit of a lifetime that never came back again. The sense of the sacredness of life and the impossibility of destroying it." Men whom other men had killed. What kind of inhumanity could men inflict on other humans? I think this description of Garfield gives us a kind of glimpse into the capacities for inhumanity that were to become all too common in the century that followed. The destabilizing of a belief in fundamental human goodness and possibility that introduced the beginnings of a habit of irony and doubt into a mid-19th century world, habits that became so much a part of the World War I generation and the battles and carnage of the 20th century. We live still with many legacies of the Civil War, its legacy of freedom, its legacy of nationhood. But I would like to add to that set of legacies, the legacy of death. It helped the death of the Civil War and the requirements that it made on the federal government to act differently in relationship to its citizens, helped to organize and shape an enormous bureaucracy, a bureaucracy of reburial, a bureaucracy of pensions, a bureaucracy of responsibility to citizens that became a defining aspect of the nation state that emerged as the very strong power that the United States became in the late 19th century. And the legacy of death also introduced human challenges into human beings' understandings of themselves and their assumptions about what William Dean Howells called the sacredness of life. And these have been, in many ways, the foundation of what is often called modernity. So death created our American nation in two ways. First, by preserving the Union through sacrifice in the nation's behalf. But secondly, by creating a nation state with the scale and responsibility and the understanding of the wide range of duties and obligations it has to its citizens, both living and the dead. Thank you very much.
Okay, we have time for some questions, but if I may, I would like to ask you on this question of legacies of the Civil War. How much do you think holding on to the war affects American life today? For example, in the celebration of the 150th anniversary, and I could be wrong, but I have a sense that the South is much more into this than the North. And it's interesting, the South as the side that lost, you weren't supposed to give this away, lost the war, is much more interested in speaking about this than the North. How much of this is healthy is what I'm getting at. I mean, we're historians, and we like to think about the past. But the South is changing in very, very many ways now. Many of the people who are living now there, the huge growth of Hispanics in the South, immigrants, people who don't have any memory of that, and yet one part of the South is holding on to it, and the other part doesn't understand it, and the North seems to have moved on. So how much of a legacy should remain before it becomes something that's problematic?
Do we still have Confederates in the attic, Tony?
it's a big question. I find when I go back to the South now compared to, say, 15 years ago when I was researching Confederates in the attic, it has changed. I think issues like the rebel flag, the temperature has gone down a lot. And also, people have found new enemies. Immigrants seems to be a much bigger obsession now than Yankees. And I gave a talk about John Brown in Charleston back on the anniversary in April and tried to be a little bit like John Brown and, you know, really try and fire things up just for the heck of it. And when it got to the question and answer, the only complaint was that I'd been a little hard on Lincoln. And I thought, oh my God, if South Carolina is going soft on me. Now, I don't mean to be flip here, but I do think I'm not living in the South anymore. I'd like to hear from you all. I've probably spent more time recently than I have.
Well, you know, I've actually been struck going around in this anniversary year and hearing from readers of my book and talking to people how, you know, I had expected, Annette, that as you suggest, this would be more of a live wire in the South, but I've actually found maybe even stronger feelings emerging in the North. Totally what I didn't expect. But, you know, I think a big reason for the fascination of the Civil War is that our politics often feel like they're about to go over the brink, like they're about to pitch over the brink from incivility into something much worse. In fact, I've gotten asked time and again this year, don't you think that our politics today are just as bad in terms of the divisiveness and aggression and polarization as they were in 1860 and 61? To which I have to say, well, no. You know, people are not waving revolvers at each other on the floor of the House. They're not caning each other on the floor of the Senate. But I think our politics, you know, even our language of politics is a military language. We talk about campaigns and fighting for what you believe in, and these are all positive virtues, and yet there's also an insecurity with the possibility that it might pitch over the brink, and the Civil War was the one time that happened. And so I actually found, I began writing for a New York Times series about the Civil War last fall, and it began the day before the midterm elections. And I found a lot of people after the midterm elections were saying, well, those Confederates are just like the Tea Party today. And people wanted to refight the Civil War on those terms, too. So it's not just about race, and it's not just about Southern grievances.
But it's striking to me that during the centennial of the Civil War, it was the in the midst of the battles surrounding the civil rights movement, and each of the history and the present played off each other in such dramatic and conflict-ridden ways. But now I see some of the battles around a different aspect of Civil War history, which is the question of how much power should be in the hands of the federal government and how much power should be in the hands of individuals or the states. And we have a candidate running for the Republican nomination who's talked about secession from the United States. So we have that language coming up again. So I think we need to understand the war because it is such a kind of touchstone for so much of how we identify ourselves, and we need to make sure the real history and the depths of the real history are understood, and it doesn't just get exploited in a sense for whatever the current arguments are.
I had a gentleman a few weeks ago in North Florida raise his hand after my talk and inform me that the Civil War was not about slavery, it was about high federal taxes.
These are very good examples of what they are. I'd like just to move slightly in this, but bring it back, I think, to what we're talking about. And I think that I regret that, and I don't think I'm wrong about this, the great demise of civics courses in our high schools and, you know, virtually everywhere. And because I think it would be a very good thing to have these next generations have some idea of the responsibilities and obligations of citizenship, which I think are lacking. And if I may, that will take me to the fact that I still see, hear, discuss with people or listen to them bring out the secession issue, that they think there still is a constitutional right to secede. And what I like to flip down on the table as a card is that in a wonderfully understated and yet typically Robert E. Lee eloquent way, Lee, after the war, the first time this was brought up to him, he said, that issue has been decided by force of arms. And I think we should live with that.
So, questions from the audience? We have a microphone here, I think. It's my imagination. No mic, sorry. No questions?
There's a question right there. It's impossible to see from up here.
Thank you for taking my question. It's a wonderful experience to hear you all. This is a question for President Faust. I've heard it's been said that if the level of casualties in the Civil War had been duly noted in Europe, it might have prevented World War I. And that one tragedy of history, if one will, would be the fact that in Europe people were apparently too preoccupied with empire and other things to notice these implications. They were caused, the Professor Schott, who made this observation, said, Timothy Schott at Kenyon, said that people in the Civil War, Americans discovered and revealed to the world the fact that technology, military technology, had outstripped strategy. And this is what caused the 620,000 deaths of which you speak, although not the infections, et cetera, that followed. Anyway, do you think that, do you agree with this impression that had Europe noticed this, the casualties, or World War I might have been ameliorated or prevented? Thank you.
I would take what you said more as a comment than a question. I think it's a really interesting observation and one that has a lot of merit. I don't know, we can't rewrite history and say, well, here they took notice and therefore everything changed. One would hope that had there been more notice taken that the folly, some of the folly at least of World War I might have been eliminated, but the capacity of humans for folly often exceeds rational explanation, so I'm not sure it would have had a completely transformative effect. But as I thought about this issue of death in the Civil War, I thought often of the kind of historical writing that's been done about World War I as a kind of pivot point in human consciousness and human experience. And I came to feel that we needed to move backwards some of that notion of a pivot and put it in the Civil War era. But I think also in the United States itself, there was much suppression of the larger meaning of that war. And when I talked about glimpses of irony, I think it was glimpses of the horror and glimpses of the kind of realistic assessment that I identify and see in people like Emily Dickinson's poetry, which of course was never published until late in the 19th century, so it could not be widespread in its impact. Ambrose Bierce, who was seen as quirky in his perceptions. Melville, whose darkness was not popular at all and was honored much later. So really the digesting and embrace of the meaning of the death in the United States, even in the United States, I think was not fully incorporated. So because it was such a departure from people's prior experience.
Well, I'm afraid, unfortunately, this is all the time we have for questions. I'd like to thank the panel for this and to thank the audience for their attention.
So here's the Civil War nerd question.